All right. Welcome to the top 10 production experiences with Service Manager and Orchestrator. My name is Nathan Lesnoski. I'm an infrastructure architect for Concurrency, and I'm Microsoft MVP in virtualization and systems management. What are my production experiences? I've been responsible for the two largest implementations of Service Manager in the world, serving many hundreds of thousands of users. I've been working with Orchestrator since the early beta, so about 5 or 6 years. And we've had success with both the technology and with the process. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Just a quick show of hands. Who in the room would be the IT process owner? Wow, awesome. Very few percentage. Who would be the technology owner? Who would be the person implementing tool sets? All right. So, this presentation is going to be grouped into two things. We're going to be talking about a lot of technology, because that's one of the things that I love to do. I love talking about the technology. I love the nuts and bolts. I love seeing how we can automate something and make it better, right? So we're going to spend a lot of time dealing with how to be able to effectively implement components of Service Manager and not run over bumps in the road. We're also going to talk a little bit about process transformation. And the reason why is because although you folks are principally the technical individuals in the room, I want to make sure you have a solid understanding of what your process owners are going to be expecting from you in order to be successful with Service Manager. What I've found in my implementations of Service Manager as a consultant is that if we simply look at Service Manager as a technology solution and not as a process solution, we ultimately fail because we don't get the win with the business. That's in contrast to something like Exchange or Link or Active Directory, right? Where you're delivering something to them, and in the essence of the application, they simply know how to use it. If someone's using Exchange, they simply have Outlook. If they're using Link, they have the Link client. If they're using Active Directory, they have to log in. So these platforms are very IT-centric. And this has a lot of IT-centric aspects of it, too. But it also has a lot of process-centric aspects of it. So we're going to cover a little bit about that, and then we're going to dive into the technical details. So we're going to start with process transformation, and then we're going to deal with some different automations and some techniques in terms of how to accomplish those automations. And by following some of the techniques I'll outline today, this will help you to be able to have a sustainable automation that will last well over time, as opposed to one which will ultimately break down, and you'll spend a lot of operational time maintaining it. We're going to talk about performance. One of the things that I found the most hits a Service Manager implementation hard is if people don't effectively scale for performance. So we'll talk about what your Service Manager environment should look like in order to be successful. We'll talk about data visualization, which is really about how do we take the data that's in Service Manager and present it to different people in ways that they want to consume it. And then also, I have a whole bunch of leave-behinds for you technical folks. So I have planning spreadsheets. I have ready-to-go scripts on Service Manager. I have some service request extensions management packs that you guys can get. I have an Orchestrator runbook example for you guys to go and test yourselves in your own Orchestrator implementations. Who has Orchestrator installed today? Yes, that's awesome. And a little bit on configuring data visualization and through a step-by-step procedure. All right. So what can you expect from Service Manager? We found as consultants that Service Manager projects fit into four main buckets. The first bucket is work process and service visibility. What that really means is you guys all have bosses that want to know what you're doing. And they want to be able to look at the work that you're doing in some kind of pretty or organized way so they can take it back to the business and explain why they need to hire another IT person to support you or why they need to be able to send you guys to cool conferences like TechEd. So work process and service visibility is just that. That's kind of what people have always thought about when they think about service management. They think about these processes that you're going through, and you're managing the work that people are doing on a day-to-day basis. What's awesome about Service Manager is it's not just process automation. It's not just work process management. It's common task automation. So what we have in Service Manager, what we're going to spend a good deal of today on, is how do we take the processes that we do manually and automate them so we can replace the manual efforts we spend with automated efforts. We're going to talk about skill-to-task alignment, which is saying, I want to make sure my engineers who have the skills to be able to do interesting and important things are able to use their time to do that. So that's what we're accomplishing through common task automation, is we're optimizing who's doing what, and we're automating things that are manual. And also configuration and resource management. Configuration and resource management is all about taking your CMDB and hooking it into these different parts of your infrastructure. So that way you're not maintaining your configuration manually, and instead you're having it update automatically based upon models that you build. So I'll walk you through that. All right, so how do we get started? First, you need to include the right people, particularly because you folks are mostly IT people. If you don't include business stakeholders in your service management implementation, you're going to struggle with it. So you need immediately to get your service desk manager, your IT leadership involved, so they feel like it's their idea. They feel like, oh, I'm going to be optimizing the way my people do work, and we're going to use this tool to do it. And it's going to make their lives so much easier, plus I'm going to save money because we're going to take these regular tasks and we're going to automate them. Get their buy-in, and it's going to be way more successful because your IT leadership can then sell that to the rest of the business. The second part is start with services. Who has taken time to write out a service catalog? Okay, pretty small percentage of us right now. So what about a service listing of the things that you deliver to a business? Who's taken the time to go and do that? Okay, another small percentage. So what is a service? A service is something that we deliver to the business. It's anything we deliver to the business. It's an abstracted idea of something we deliver. Internet portal, email, warehouse, something we deliver. So that something is articulated in Service Manager as a business service. And that's the place we start, because that's the place that brings everything together. And I'll show you that in a second. When we think about a service, like Exchange or Link or Active Directory, those all relate to metrics that we want to display, and that's where that visibility comes in. So if we say, hey, I want to know whether or not my Exchange environment is healthy, and how much it costs to support it, and whether or not people are overworked, and what I'm doing automatically versus manually, all that should be able to be represented in a scorecard like this. And then when the IT leadership want to know about how you're spending your time, present them a scorecard. Don't have to go on and on about emails. We're able to present them real metrics about what we're doing. So how does this relate? We start with service planning. So the way we do it, we simply start with a worksheet. Every engagement, every consulting engagement, we start with a worksheet, and we say, let's list off all the things that we deliver to the business. And it could be IT core infrastructure services. Like you can see up there, I have Microsoft core infrastructure, and I have management infrastructure, and IT governance and communications. All these things that we do that the business barely understands that we do because we've never articulated it to them. So the idea behind creating a business services list is this starts our opportunity to be able to organize what we do and who's responsible for it. And it may have been something that you push up the chain and you say, here, IT leadership, organize this list of things we do. And from this, we're then going to start with delivering our IT services and our configuration and our automations. All right. So where does that fit? Let me jump you into Service Manager here. All right. So this is my service manager environment at Concurrency. I've got a whole bunch of business services listed. Now, a lot of times when I look at existing service manager implementations, they've never touched this. It's just kind of sitting there. But this is one of the coolest parts, because these services articulate what we do. So here's Active Directory, right? This represents its service status, its classification, its priority, the people responsible for serving that service. Now, the reason I've articulated these people here is because when I perform an automation, I can now grab these people and push them into approvals, into work processes, into manual processes or automations. These people I can then leverage for assignments and all sorts of other things inside of Service Manager. So this is information I'm starting from to be able to deliver. Also, this abstract service of Active Directory is represented by a logical service, which makes up its components. So you see where I have my different domain controllers that are listed up there? Those domain controllers were synchronized from Operations Manager. So every time I build a service, I relate it to the service in Operations Manager. So it synchronizes in all these configurations, and then allows for me to be able to have one CMDB that makes up my Active Directory and shows me what's in it. So if someone adds an Active Directory domain controller, it's synchronized into my CMDB. I can then kick off a change record that says, hey, somebody just added a domain controller without having to change. So it allows for me technically, on the technical side, to say, hey, here's my configuration, what I'm managing. And then on the business side, you're representing that IT service. And then also associated with the service, you see how I have all my incidents and service requests? So there's a bunch of incidents. Here's a here's an issue with the wireless internet not working. I wonder what that is. And then also we have our new user requests and our failed requests and so on. These are all associated with this individual Active Directory service. And then we also have the history of the service as relates to that overarching process. So this is very valuable to me because it allows for me to understand what it is I'm delivering and all the components of it. And that's why we start with that particular piece of Service Manager as a go-forward point. All right. The next thing to do is to make sure you choose your processes strategically. So most of the time when people think about Service Manager, they think incident management. They think, I'm dealing with what's broken in my environment. And I'm replacing something that deals with what's broken in my environment, ticket tracking. However, what I find is that in Service Manager, oftentimes the best process to start with is not incident management. It might be service request management. Because service request management allows for me in IT to quickly deliver them something tangible that's making a difference in their environment, and then show them very quickly where their ROI is, and then bring over incident management. Because most of the time, when people have an incident management system and they're converting to another incident management system, articulating the ROI behind that is really difficult. And it takes a long time. And then you also have to deal with, am I moving my old data over? Well, service request management, oftentimes nobody has anything for automation in service request management. So it allows for me to deal with that faster, get an immediate ROI, and then bring over other services. So if you're looking at how to approach this in your environment, that's an area to focus on. Change management is also a great area to focus on in service management because it allows for me to be able to address IT functions in a structured way. And I can use service requests to be able to structure the level of change requests based upon intelligent questions. So rather than someone come out and say, is this a major or a minor change request, you say, what systems is this impacting? Are they going to be down, or what's the risk of them being down? So you can ask questions that are going to be much more intelligent that allows the system to determine the change request match, change request classification. And then risk and compliance. Risk and compliance uses a management pack called the risk and compliance management pack. Imagine that. And it allows you to be able to organize your operational processes that are used to mitigate risks in your environment. So like, let's say that I have a risk of a data disaster, or I have a risk of my internet going out, or I have a risk of a backup situation happening. Well, I have these operational processes that mitigate that. So I can focus on those operational processes and build incident functions to be able to mitigate those, such as checking the backups or validating I've ever done an internet and so on. So that allows me to construct those processes. All right. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk a little bit about process transformation. And we're going to tie that into our automations. So what's the difference between our current incident management and good incident management? A lot of systems, a lot of companies, when they're dealing with incident management, have very poor incident escalation and organization procedures. So they receive an email, they're trying to figure out what's going on, the person who deals with the system's gone, you have no idea what the configuration of the system is. So let's say I have SharePoint down, and someone calls in, and the guy who deals with SharePoint's gone. How do I deal with that? It's very difficult. With good incident management, I align my issue with the services that are in the stack. And then I can also correlate those issues to other services. So if my SharePoint's down because Active Directory's down, I can correlate that and map it back. And then I can show data back to the business about what I'm working on and how it relates. The same thing happens with service request management. So when I'm looking at a service request, a lot of service requests come in like this. It's, hey, I like a new SharePoint site, and I want it today. That new SharePoint site then goes back and forth on a bunch of emails trying to organize what it is the person actually wants. With good service request management, what we're doing is we're capturing good information from the user, and then we're using that either to accomplish that requirement faster, or we're automating the requirement altogether. And that allows for me to do some pretty fantastic things. All right. Now I'll show you this on a demo. Now, building automations. Let's get into it. What are we doing when we're building automations? And what are we doing when we're building process enhancement? We're trying to save time, avoid cost, and quicken our time to deploy, be able to improve the experience that our users are getting. I always go after the low-hanging fruit, because the low-hanging fruit is where we're going to have a pretty advantageous deployment, and we're going to see people get excited about it right away. So the first request that I'm going to show you today is going to be new user request. This is my favorite request type, because it's super simple to set up. Everybody needs it. Everybody needs a new user request process. And there's so many places I can automate. So in our automation, what we do is we create a new Active Directory account. We enable the Exchange mailbox. We enable a link mailbox. We set a home directory. We allow them to do picture population. We set their manager and the drink attribute, which is sort of a hidden attribute in Active Directory. And then actually something that's on here that I don't have in the list is we allow them to copy another user's rights. So most of the time when someone gets created, they say, make this person like, make him like Steve, because Steve's got all the same rights. Some companies have templates. So they say, oh, this is an accounting template. But a lot of times those templates don't stay current. So this serves both those needs, either companies that have great templates or companies that don't. All right. So I'm going to come out to my service catalog. My service catalog is one of the two principal user experiences in Service Manager. The other user experience, of course, is the console experience. Now, in my self-service catalog, I have a section called Account Emails and File Access. This is intended to be used by, say, an HR user. Your typical user isn't going to see this. I'm going to come out and do an account management request. And you'll note I have two different types of requests, a new user request and a remove user request. Go to my request form, and let's call him or her Molly Tech E. And her middle initial is J. And she's going to be in the infrastructure department, and she likes juice with scotch. And she's going to go to start date of today. And then what I have here is I have a query of all the existing users in my environment. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to search for Linda. And then I'm going to select Linda as a user that I intend to copy. Now, I could do a multi-select list here. There's nothing stopping me from saying I want to select four people whose rights I'm going to copy. But that logic could get a little bit more complex. What I find is that this scenario serves about 90% of what most companies are looking for in a new user provisioning process. And those other percentages might be SAP, might be some green screen application that there's no interface to, or so on. And those are areas that we would build on. All right, so I'm going to submit this. And as a user, I can come out here and view my individual requests. Now, I'm going to jump into Orchestrator and show you a little bit about how this works. Now, Orchestrator is a pretty fantastic tool, and it facilitates some pretty awesome things. Now, I'm going to show you a little bit about this technique here and how you can use this in your environment. Now, in every orchestration process, the first step is called initialize data, especially if you're interacting with Service Manager, at least. The first step is initialize data. And what initialized data allows me to do is it allows me to bring information over from Service Manager. So Service Manager, as you can see, is passing different properties over and allowing me to consume those through my automation. Now, you'll notice that I am not consuming all the properties that I set. So there's nothing in there about the user I'm copying, right? But what there is there's something very important called an activity ID. What an activity ID allows me to do is allows me to reach back into Service Manager to grab all sorts of other data. So what I think is very useful knowledge about your automations is that passing this is a great way to start because it's very understandable, but it doesn't scale very well over time. Because what ends up happening is you end up modifying the things you want to pass. And if you modify these values, there's all sorts of hooks in Service Manager that you have to fix, at least now. So you can arm yourself with the activity ID to be able to grab parameters that you hadn't previously passed. So anytime you're building an automation, always remember to have your activity ID in your passing of your information, even if you're passing other values out of the stack. Also know that any related item, so when I created my request, I had a related user to that request. That related user cannot be passed in a text variable. They have to be passed, they have to be gone back into the request to grab. So that's very important. So now you'll notice that I pass this information over, and the next step that I'm doing is I'm getting the runbook. And I'm getting this runbook based upon the activity ID that matches it. So here's my activity ID from initialized data. I'm looking for the object GUID from Service Manager that matches it. So that's my starting point. Then I'm getting what's called a related item. The related item is finding what is the related service request to the runbook automation activity that kicked this off. The reason for that is because that's allowing me to then get my service request. My service request is then matches the related object ID from get service request. So there's my get service request, which you'll see is the previous step. That includes the related object GUID that then I'm grabbing through get service request. I'm also then getting the service request extensions. What are service request extensions? Well, if you've done a service request, you've probably found that you've got to store the answers to your questions somewhere, right? And out of box, you can store them in a couple places. You can store them in past variables. You can store them in title and description. But sooner or later, you run out. And then you're searching for where to store these things. So what we did is we basically created a sealed management pack that includes 20 extra string requests, string variables, and integers, and dates, and so on. And that allows us to store that information so we can pass it later. So we have these generic variables that we take advantage of. We've done that by extending our service request, the out-of-box service request, with these additional variables. So I'm getting that extension. I'm then passing that information to a PowerShell script. So in the PowerShell script, what I'm doing is you see I can pull first name, last name, department from initialized data. That's the information that I passed over from the initial step. But then I'm also performing operations like grabbing middle initials, creating common names, and then I have a try-catch loop to be able to, if the user exists, I'm then going and adding a middle initial to the username that's being created. So that allows for me to be able to deal with issues in the creation of that user account. And then based upon who that user is, I then create different types of user accounts. Now, I did this sort of as a matter of explanation, because you don't necessarily have to have this kind of branching structure here to be able to deal with different types of users. Inside of the context of here, what I'm doing is I'm excluding these other departments from these branches. But what you could do just as easily is you could send information to just one of these to be able to define manager variables. In our case, we're creating a user that has that manager variable information in it based upon the branch, just as a matter of example. That then enables the user and creates the mailbox in exchange. You'll notice that instead of displaying my password to you, I'm grabbing it from a text file and converting it to a secure string. So that allows me to hide that password from the person who's responsible for the automation. Because as much as we as IT would love to have everybody's passwords for these service requests, a lot of times these teams aren't willing to give that up. So we can have them enter in that information, and then we can lock it up so we can't see it. We then get the user we just created and create the link user account, and then we do something really special. We go and we get the user who is the related user. So in here it says get created by user, and then we get the template user ID, and in this case we're getting the created by user ID. So we get the related created by user ID, and then get his information, and then get the template user ID and that person's information. Now, how do we know which is which? We know which is which because the relationship class in those different user relationships is different. So the user that we've related is called isRelatedToConfiguration, whereas this one is called createdByUser. So we're able to use that information to be able to differentiate which information we're pulling from the request. And then we use PowerShell to be able to actually apply that information. So and this is actually really simple. You don't have to use any of the Quest inputs or anything. It all works with Windows Server 2008 R2. So we're pulling the PowerShell module for Active Directory, set the execution policy, and then we're grabbing the source user. We're doing a try-catch in case it fails. And then what we do is we grab the hash table, or we create a hash table of all the source users' groups. For each sourceCN in sourceUser.memberOf, this is basically just a mechanism to grab all the groups for that user. We then go out and we add our user to those groups. Works like a champ. And it's so much easier than going out and having to do this all manually. And then we send an email indicating that it was completed. So you can see that the one that we just performed went through all of its steps. Here's all the steps that it had. And then we can also see information about what was passed at any given point. So in our case, if I go to our initial step, initialize data, I can see the information that I passed over, like the username that I had, person's first name, last name, and so on. So in that example, we're grabbing that information, passing it through, and automating. And this is one of the examples that I posted up on the Leave Behind section for you guys to check out and try for yourselves. So I think it's pretty neat. Remove Active Directory users is also very useful. This allows for us to do the exact opposite thing, which is take them out. One of the examples that I did for remove Active Directory user, what we did is we actually, instead of deleting user, we actually did an update user. So we said, when do you want this person to be terminated? So we'd say, hey, on Friday, we want this person to be terminated. So we can then update the user's information to end, for their account to end at that particular date. And we can do that just as a matter of the automation. We don't even have to have a wait process in the orchestration for that to happen. So it's got a lot of capability there. All right. Now, just to show you a little bit of an example of that extension that we're using. So our service request extensions management pack is basically the service request. As you can see, it has this typical static components, like its ID and its closing date and its work items and so on. But then we have all these extra values that we've added onto each service request that we store that information in. So we're going back into the service request to get that generic data. And we found that this has been an awesome way to be able to maintain that information over time. Let's go into another type of request. Another type of request is going to be application self-service. Application self-service allows me to be able to arm my users or arm my IT people with a great process for deploying IT applications or end-user applications. This has saved companies that we've worked with thousands and thousands and thousands of hours because it's facilitated these things that the IT team used to do very manually. All right. I'm going to go back out to my self-service portal. And in my self-service portal, I have a request called My Local Applications. And My Local Applications is going to give me some information that is stored in my CMDB. Now, what I'm immediately presented with is my PC. And the reason I'm presented with my PC is because in the CMDB, SCCM has synchronized the PCs that I'm the primary user for. So I'm presenting this through a view that with the advanced computer view, which is typically a no-no. You typically don't want to use the advanced computer view in any kind of view because it doesn't perform very well because it gets so much information and brings it back. But in this case, I'm doing a search. So I'm saying, give me just the computers that the user going into the portal is the primary user for. So I can select my user. And then I also can select from a list of applications. Now, you notice that I only have a couple applications listed. Inside of my CMDB, so if I come out here and I look at all my software, right? I've got, what do I have? 1,300 different software products. I just did a project that had over 100,000 unique software items. That's a lot of software items, right? But check this out. In our published software, we only have a couple. Now, What's neat about this is the link that is detected by SCCM is the exact same link that we're using to be able to do the deployment. So when Link gets installed on a person's workstation, it shows up in the CMDB. And we have the relationship to how in SCCM we're going to uninstall and install it. So now we have two ways that we can do this. We can use the Microsoft-created approval engine that's on the System Center Engineering blog today. And there's a lot of good examples from some folks who have built different manager approvals and such in there. If you want to make something slightly more sophisticated than that, what you can do is you can build something kind of what we're talking about here. So when you look at my Microsoft link, what you'll notice is it's got most of the normal information that you'd expect. But then all of a sudden, you've got all these other fields. Now, the reason why you have all these other fields is because this is how we're differentiating whether or not things are available on the portal or not. So I can see I have portal name and IT name, whether or not approval is required, whether or not portal displays there, the collection IDs in SCCM for the installation, as well as package installation information that we use during operating system deployment. This is so cool because it allows for us, when the product is detected on a person's system, to be able to have the installation and uninstallation information right there. Now, the way that we're differentiating whether or not it's exposed to the portal is whether or not it's exposed through a portal display. You could use a drop-down list there, too, if you wanted to. All right. So in my automation, we come out in the portal, and the person is allowed to deploy that individual app. And they're also presented with whether or not approval is required on that particular application. And then we ask them for whether or not it's required for their job role. What's neat is the automation for this is actually really simple. So this is called package deployment process. And in here, we do all those same things. So you notice in this case, we only pass the activity ID. We're not even passing out other information because we're just going back into Service Manager to get the information from the request. So we're getting the service request, the computer name that we're deploying to, and we're getting the software. So that's passing it into this get software relationship. So every time you're getting something from Service Manager, what you're doing is you're making a connection to the Service Manager. You're indicating that you have a particular class you want to pull information from, which is either, in this case, software items or extension of software items. And then you're filtering the list that you're pulling based upon the information from the service request. We then set a collection to allow us to be able to force the workstation to go into a collection based upon its bit type. So if it's a 32-bit or 64-bit, we're sending it into different collections. And then we go and add the computer to the collection using the out-of-box add computer and refresh computer collection steps. This is really easy to do, doesn't take a lot of work, and it's something that you can craft to do some pretty sophisticated things. So if you want to insert an approval, you just look at what was in that request, and you say, okay, send an approval over to the service manager before this thing gets deployed. We have the approval step. Allows you to do all sorts of great automations around what type of software gets installed based upon the computer that was selected, or even if there's multiple computers selected. We use this also a lot with IT folks. A lot of times, the IT folks that you're managing, they don't know how to use SCCM as well as you do. So what you can do is you can build IT-centric application deployment steps that exist in the self-service portal of Service Manager that they can then use to be able to deploy those applications from the self-service portal. So they select multiple systems or multiple users that they can then use to deploy. All right. Workstation deployment and reimage. Workstation deployment and reimage is an example that pulls together our existing knowledge that we've gathered from the system. So right now we know that we can create a new user, we can deploy applications. What if we wanted to pull the existing applications on a system or deploy an operating system from scratch? Usually that's done entirely from the SCCM interface. In this case, we can do it all from the self-service portal and service manager with significantly less IT knowledge necessary on the deployer side. All right. In this case, let's get out of orchestrator here. Back to our self-service portal. In our self-service portal, what we have is either enterprise workstation deployment if I'm an IT person, or my computer if I'm a computer individual, if I'm a guy using his own computer. I'm going to go to enterprise workstation deployment because I'm going to pretend that I'm an IT person going and doing a deployment. Now, in enterprise IT workstation deployment, what I'm doing is I'm getting a MAC address. That's sort of my starting point. I've got a bunch of systems that are bare metal. And I enter in a MAC address. Let's say 11, 11, 11, 11, 11 is my MAC address. Now, this is an important technique for you guys to know. If you have more than 2,000 users in your environment, who has more than 2,000 users? Okay. So you don't want to provide the user doing deployments a gigantic list of users that you're going to search from, because every time you go to this particular view, it's literally going out and pulling back all 2,000 of these users or 4,000 of those users. So there's examples of how you can expand the size of that range, but it's kind of untenable. So I've dealt with ones that are in the 20, 30, and way over that range, right? So in order for this to be able to, you know what this looks like when you open it up when it's in that range? It looks like a spinning, loading, please wait screen, right? So how do we deal with that and make it a lot faster? We deal with it by functioning in a search mode. So we say, okay, let's look for users. And now it brought back just the users that I want to see, as opposed to every single user in my entire environment. And that allows for me to avoid the significant I/O that takes place when you're bringing back all that data. It also allows me to use more flexible classes, because instead of bringing back everybody's data, I'm bringing back just the users that I want to see. And then I can get more information about those users. Okay. I then select a language. So if I want this to be running in English or French or Spanish or whatever language, I can select that. And then I can select the applications that I want to deploy in this particular case. Now, the way that this then works is in Orchestrator, I have an OS deployment process. And that OS deployment process allows for me to be able to pull that MAC address information and push that into MDT in SCCM. So you'll notice the same exact structure, right? I'm getting my runbook activity, my service request, my extensions, my assigned user. I'm getting the required OU, the computer's administrators, their locale based upon the language I selected, time zone information, all based upon the language I selected. And then I'm kicking that into bare metal install components and then mapping it to site code based upon the geographic location. I then tie that into adding additional values to the database for MDT, and I add packages to MDT based upon the software product. This is all doable through automation. And building this whole thing probably took me a week. Imagine doing that for thousands of computer requests. That saves you ridiculous amounts of time. So this is another example of where you can use Orchestrator in conjunction with Service Manager to be able to implement these kinds of techniques. But you'll see, it follows a very repeatable pattern. It's all using the same kind of pattern in how I'm doing this. All right. Let's do one more just for fun. This is one that I challenge you guys to try after the session because it's really easy. My Twitter posts. I took some time this morning. I was bored and I was like, okay, let's figure out something else neat that we could do at TechEd. So I built a Twitter posting application in Service Manager. And what's interesting is I first constructed it entirely with PowerShell. And then I found out that there's an orchestrator integration pack specifically for Twitter. And I thought, well, that's just wasted all that time. But now you can see both, right? All right, so let's say in session MGT331T12. Okay. So how does that work? Well, ridiculously easy, actually. So I use the exact same structure, right? I bring over my activity ID. I bring over my runbooks and my service requests. And then I tweet out the information using the Vicode tweet application for our tweet integration pack for Orchestrator. Super simple. Took me all 5 minutes to set this up, as opposed to the PowerShell, which took me a little bit longer. And this then allows for me to build the connection to Twitter, and then also bring over the string that I had in my service request extensions. Very easy to do, works seamlessly, straightforward to implement. This is an example of how almost anything can be built inside of Service Manager, whether it's Twitter or it's a complex deployment process. All these have drastic payoffs, with the exception of maybe the Twitter thing, of course. Some other examples of things that I can show you a little later after we get through some of these other components are going to be SharePoint automations, computer refresh, in-place computer refresh, permissions changes, file server permissions management, and so on. All these things are very easy to do and are great low-hanging fruit. You know, I love the idea of server deployment through self-service portals, but when users are given these kinds of tools, they're able to do things a lot faster and they realize the ROI you've given them versus necessarily just delivering cloud automation, which is really valuable, but valuable to a smaller scope or visible to a smaller scope of people in my environment. Okay, so how do we go through the process of creating these requests? Well, we plan them first. And the way we plan them first is we sit down with our user and we say, what kind of questions do you want to ask when you go through a new user request? Now, this is a great way to engineer this because it allows for you to be able to make the user feel like they're really involved. And most of the times, I've already gone through the process of building this all out, right? This is a super reusable new user request. And I'm just kind of using it over and over. But the cool thing about it is you're able to tweak it here and there to make the user feel like they really got exactly what they're looking for, because they did. They gave you that input. And in the planning process, you then go through this in a spreadsheet. So I posted this up there as well as ways to be able to grab that information. And then you're also then documenting the mapping of relationships between those fields and the items in your service requests. Because whether you like it or not, you may have a need to fix this because somebody made a change to it that it shouldn't have. So by documenting your relationships inside of these systems and the relationship between the service request and the orchestration, you then give yourself the opportunity to fix it. That's sort of a backup to the idea of backing up your management packs on a regular basis. Okay. Another big tip is make your service catalog your one-stop shop for IT. And that's not just your IT folks, and that's not just your end user folks. Put all your major requests that you can manage in your self-service portal, because that allows for your people in IT to be able to have faster ways of doing things, and your end users to have better ways of doing things too. It's all in one place. I found that that creates a drastic change in terms of how people are consuming from IT, and it also fixes issues with standardization. Like that new user request process, a lot of times we implement that after a company has a drastically screwed up Active Directory, because people are creating users wherever the heck they feel like it, they're copying user permissions, they're just moving users from thing to thing, and they're not in the right OUs, they're not in the right groups. What we can do with this is we can say, fine, if you want to create a user, use the self-service request. If you want to remove a user, use a remove self-service request. If you want to modify their groups, use a modify group self-service request. It takes us not very long to deploy those, and they can do it faster. They don't have to be inside of Active Directory users or computers. They could be at their computer halfway across the world and do this request. So it helps them out. Next item is don't forget about business intelligence and reports. Who has Performance Point enabled with Service Manager deployed right now? Wow, okay. So this is a rock star component of Service Manager. The visibility that you get through Performance Point tied into Service Manager is the perfect solution for your CIOs and your main business decision makers. And the reason why is because it takes the data you have in your CMDB and presents it up right where they're working. So instead of it being something that they have to dig into and ask for this custom report and, oh, I don't like the way this column is organized and I want it somewhere else, this allows for you just to simply say, here's my IT site. Here's the Performance Point view that I want you to look at. Now, it's really not that hard to set up. If you want to have a really nice step-by-step process, check out these two links. A colleague of mine went and he basically screenshotted each of the individual setup processes of enabling and configuring Performance Point in SharePoint 2010, which is not really a service manager skill set, it's more of a SharePoint skill set. And then also configuring the reporting mechanisms and dashboards inside of that Performance Point service and presenting them through a self-service portal. So that'll allow you to have that kind of visibility. So what does this look like? I'll just give you a quick example. So what I can do is I can present information up in my self-service portal that represents different types of data that I want to present to these people. So if I were to say, OK, let's look at this data in a way that provides me more visibility into what I'm looking at. And then I can dig into a decomposition tree. So I can see, for example, here's all 16 of my incidents. And then let's look at the incident classification. So let's bust that out. Let's see how they're divided over time. Looks like most of them are hardware problems. Then let's expand it into my affected users and go to their display name. And I can see that I'm responsible for four of them versus Chuck being responsible for one. Now I can keep digging into this. And what's great about it is I didn't have to have any call from my CIO who's saying, hey, show me how to dig into, you know, create a report that shows me the relationship between the users and the incidents that are hardware problems. I can just let them dig into it themselves if I give them a little bit of skills to be able to do this. And this is something that I think provides a great deal more visibility. What I found is really neat is this doesn't just fit CIOs and doesn't just fit IT decision makers. You can do the same thing for the end user. You could say, show the end user all of their incidents over time that they've opened over a 2-year period and give them data about how they're being managed. And that's very useful to them. This is all through out-of-box, OLAP queues. So it's not something that I even had to build. So if you follow those guides, you'll actually have a really straightforward way of getting those configured for yourselves. All right. Now let's go into sizing. Service manager at minimum is in Orchestrator really four servers. In bigger implementations, it's quite a bit more. You have at minimum a service manager management server. The first management server in your enterprise runs all the workflows. That's sort of non-negotiable at this point. It's responsible for all workflow running. It's responsible for all I/O to and from your console and the database. If you need to deal with greater numbers of consoles, then you add additional management servers. Know that that main management server is still running the workflows. So what tends to happen is once your environment grows, you shift your console users off of the main management server and onto what we might call like an access management server. You can also load balance them if you want it to be highly available. And you can also check out, I don't know if you guys have been kind of following the GridPro folks, but they have a really cool self-service portal that you guys can check out too, that for IT that doesn't require the console installation. You can do it through a web page. Data warehouse and SQL, these can either be co-located on one box or split out. Or you can split the two SQL servers from each other and then have the data warehouse running on a second server. And I'll show you what that enterprise topology would look like. And then Orchestrator can also have what's called a management server and then split out the actual runbook servers where the automations actually occur. Now, what this looks like in a Visio, it's kind of like this. So in an enterprise deployment, I have a principal management server and then additional management servers. I have a server that runs my data warehouse. I have my portal for SharePoint. And then at the access side, at the automation side, I have a management server for Orchestrator. And then also executes my runbook servers, which might be out at different data centers or in the same data center. For SQL, I either have one SQL server or I have split SQL servers based upon what it is that I'm actually running. In a lot of cases, I'm splitting those SQL servers because the workload of the data warehouse that might be maintaining information for several years is different than the workload of the operations database, which needs to be snappy for me to be able to log new incidents. So I tend to separate those because it provides me better scalability. And with virtualization, I can cut up those resources without having to buy more hardware. So that's very useful. The key thing I would share with you is don't undersize SQL. SQL is the workhorse for this entire thing. If SQL is slow, everything's slow. If you have bad disks on your SQL servers, you don't have great storage I/O, you don't have enough memory or RAM, or you don't have enough CPUs, for example, Service Manager is going to be slow. That's just all there is to it. So you need to make sure that you provide enough resources necessary for your system to scale over time. Of course, when you're starting, breaking out these roles like this is going to make you successful. Also, a couple other key things. avoid the advanced views unless you're doing searches. Advanced views are like, so if I were to think about an advanced view, a simple view is like myself. Myself is just me. But an advanced view would be, tell me not only Nathan, but tell me his brother's name and his brother's wife's name and also his dad's name and his dad's name and his mom's name and his mom's name. All these relationships, right? In a computer's case, it's the computer and the primary user and the asset that it's installed on and where it lives and what Active Directory it's memorable. It goes on and gets all its information and brings it all back. Well, if you've got 20,000 computers and you go and grab all that information, your database server is working really hard for every single view that you're presenting. So you want to avoid advanced views typically unless you're doing a search. Now, for providing some of that additional information, there's a technique called a type projection, and that allows for you to take that individual data, like me, and just say, just show me Nate and his wife. That's all I want to see. So that would allow you to present that information back without going and getting all the information in the entire world. I've seen this be a way that people start, because when they have one or two people in there and five or six incidents, no big deal. But then all of a sudden they've got 1,000 incidents or 100,000 incidents a month, and the thing is crawling because every view request is this gigantic query. Also, search versus display all data. If you've got 20,000 computers, you'll notice that your view will only display 500, right? That's by design, because if it goes and displays all 20,000, again, that's a really big query, and it's much less efficient. So what I do is I usually remove those views altogether, and then I give people just searching capabilities against big CMDBs. Also, be careful with connectors. Connectors in bigger environments tend to crush your performance, even if you have a great SQL server. Also, Configuration Manager does the same thing. All right, backup and operations. So who has Service Manager deployed today? Pretty small percentage, okay. So of all you who have deployed it today, you need to make sure that you back up your management packs regularly and also back up your encryption keys. For all those going through deployment, same thing. You just have a little bit of pre-knowledge now. If you don't back up the encryption keys, you won't be able to restore Service Manager. I'll say that again. If you don't back up your encryption keys, you won't be able to restore Service Manager. That's a really big problem for people who haven't backed up encryption keys. So the way you do that is by going out to the media. Let me just show you this once, just to make sure everybody kind of knows how to do this. So out on your Service Manager media, you have this AMD64 Tools Secure Storage Backup directory, and then run Secure Storage Backup. Even if you think that you've done it already, do it again, and make sure you wrote down the password. Because I've had that happen too. And I was like, oh crud, I don't know the password. So you end up just guessing, right? So you got to know this password. Now, of course, if you have VM backups, you're in a little bit better shape, but you're going back in time, right? Let's say everything's gone, all you got is a database. You need this. Otherwise, you're screwed. So make sure that you got that password and that you backed up your encryption keys. Also, back up your management packs. In the console, you can individually back them up, or you can back them up as MPB files, or better yet, you can actually create PowerShell commands that do it all for you. But in each of these, so you can see, for example, there's my concurrency new Active Directory user management pack, which you'll notice that I've actually segmented those. The reason I've segmented those is because it provides me with the best flexibility in terms of setting permissions against these management packs. If I combine them all into one, I have significantly less flexibility, because anytime I want to go back to an old version, I'm going back to this gigantic version that's got everything in it. And maybe I only wanted the Active Directory user stuff. And when I'm setting permissions, I'm setting all against one management pack, as opposed to being able to separate that into different management packs. So this gives me a lot more flexibility. I can export just this individual management pack. And then what happens is it creates this XML. So I'll go to an example here. Here's my CSM 2012 backup. You note that I have my encryption key, my exchange connector configuration, and all my management packs out here, right? So let's just open one up. So in here, see, it's called Business Application Installation, and it's got some dependencies, and then in here it's got its configuration, right? The cool thing about this is, because this it's just an individually exported XML, I can make modifications to this if I need to troubleshoot it. So if you had some kind of dependency that you're like, why is it dependent on that? It doesn't need that. But it's in there anyway. It allows you to be able to modify this to be able to recover it. However, I would also consider backing them up as the full MPB, so you have both in combination with each other. Note that you can't export a sealed management pack as a sealed management pack. But sealing management packs is super important whenever you're importing new individual fields in the database. So let's say that again. Like, if you're adding extensions to any existing classes or new fields, new entire classes, you can import that management pack unsealed, but it's bad news because it won't make it to the data warehouse and nothing can depend on it. So if you're ever going to extend the classes or you're ever going to put new classes in the CMDB, which most people do, almost everybody does this, because maybe you want to track the broom closets and how many brooms are in the broom closets, right? You have to seal the management pack first. The way you do that is in the authoring tool, you take your management pack. So here's an open, unsealed version of service request extensions. Right-click on it, select seal management pack, and then browse and grab your key pair, put your company in, and seal the thing. Then import it. By sealing a management pack, your version will automatically increment it. And that then allows you to maintain change control against your management packs. So that's very important anytime you're making those kinds of changes. The key point, however, going back to backup, is make sure you back up those management packs so that way you can get them back later or if someone screws them up. Also, make management pack changes during service windows. Management pack changes tend to halt service manager activity. So they can be, and also if there's a certain type of management pack change, your users will have to close the console and go back in, and they will sometimes crash. So if you don't want people to have crashing consoles, you do it during the evening or in some period where you're going to have low activity. I know some companies don't have those change windows because they're 24/7 shops, and then you're going to need to define what your change window actually is. Also, backup copies of the virtual machines. Some more general tips. Seal management packs, we talked about that already. Be careful with dependencies. Dependencies are really important to understand. Also, don't install the Operations Manager agent on Service Manager. Now, what's the reason for that? Operations Manager uses the same health service as Service Manager does. So if you install the Operations Manager agent on the Service Manager servers, your health service will fail to work. And it won't be immediately evident because everything else will work. So if you install that, what will happen is none of your workflows will fire. And you'll be able to get into some data, but nothing else will work. So there is a way to fix it. First, uninstall the Operations Manager management pack from the server. The second step is to go and delete the health service directory underneath the Service Manager database, underneath the Service Manager folder. I blogged about it. And what's funny is I was working on a project, and I ran into this issue, and I forgot completely about this problem. And I was like, oh, you have the Operations Manager agent on there. That's not supposed to be on there. So we removed it. And we're like, how do we fix this thing? So I went out to, you know, Google Bing, and I typed in my search criteria. And I came up on my own blog, and I was like, I must be getting old or something. I can't remember these things. But anyway, do make sure that you don't install Operations Manager on that. And when you do run into this problem, because you probably will, there is a way to fix it. Choose the SQL Server collation. I'm assuming most of you guys are going to need internationalization because most of the ones I work on do. So you do need to make sure you choose the right requirements for SQL Server. So there's a great blog on that already by the Service Manager team, so you can go check that out. All right. Next tip is have a development environment. If you don't have a development environment, immediately after your initial deployment, build one. It's not very costly, and it saves you big time because it's a great place to develop new management packs. It's also a great way for you to be able to test them out against your users before they get deployed to production. Plus, once they're in production, let's say you've got this automation deployed in production. How well do you think that you're going to make modifications to your automation script and orchestrator? I always screw it up the first time. You're kind of troubleshooting as you go, you know? So, like, best way to do it is to have a dev environment where you can actually test these things. Before the initial deployment, not as big of a deal because your production kind of is your dev. But what I found is that I almost always need to build one of these things either right at or right after deployment. Also, be intentional about when you move them from dev to prod, because when you're moving them from dev to prod, you're obviously modifying the workflows that are going to be running. Note that only the new workflows are going to be affected. So something in flight isn't going to be affected. And then also check performance. Note that if people use bad views, again, if they're advanced views, they're going to have bad performance. So you need to be very aware of that. All right. Don't forget training. Training is something that people always forget. They deploy Service Manager and they're like, oh, they just know how to use it. And it's fine and all. And a lot of times the self-service environment is self-explanatory, right? You should make it self-explanatory. But training people like you on how to use it, how to understand ITIL, how to understand automation, maybe some PowerShell techniques like going to Jeffrey Snover's or some of the other PowerShell sessions are great ways to get ramped up on some of the techniques that you use. The great thing is Microsoft has produced so many of these integration packs, as well as some third parties that have produced integration packs, that it allows for you to be able to leverage other people's knowledge and to get a fast ramp up. Also, have excitement when you're doing it, because people should see how this is something that's going to be a benefit to them. It's not something which is a negative and is going to cost them their job. It's simply giving them the opportunity to be able to use their skills more wisely. Because a lot of times when I say, hey, I've just automated new user creation, well, there's some guy who probably sits there all day and creates new users in this company if they're big enough. So I need to be able to show him why this is going to be good for him, so I can make that case when they're training. Also, finally, use a phased approach. I find that phased approach is my secret weapon in deploying Service Manager. Because if you don't use a phased approach, my answer is always, sure, I can do that. Because the answer usually is, sure, I can do that. If someone says, hey, can you deploy a new SharePoint self-service site creation process? I'm like, heck yeah, I love doing that. Let's do it. But the problem is that I can't do it all at once. I'm one guy, right? So I need to use a phased approach. So what I do is I basically build a work plan. So you see in my work plan, I've got these different steps. So there's like in each one of these, you've got new enterprise workstation deployment. And I've got the template, the service request, the request offering, the orchestrator components, the service manager runbook that gets synchronized over, adding the service manager runbook to the service request, and then configuration of SCCM. So I've got all those pieces all in one place, right? And I phase those out. So I'll say, here's phase one, here's phase two. If you want to do something else, and it's important enough that we hit our date, it goes in phase two. Sticking with that kind of approach and writing down what you're doing is going to save your guys' butts, because it's going to allow you to be able to make sure that your people are getting what they're asking for, but your timeline doesn't get too stretched, because iterative approaches with this, especially with automation, work really well. All right. Now, we've got about 10 minutes left. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go into a couple more technical aspects of this, but before I do, and I'm also going to answer some questions, because I want to make sure I answer enough technical questions so that way you guys feel like you are understanding some of the things I've gone through. Now, key thing for next steps is take advantage of some of those leave-behinds I have. So use your business services list, create a service catalog, sit down and do a quick ROI on your requests. You don't have to be an ROI master to create ROIs behind requests, right? The ROI behind a new user request or a new workstation deployment or app deployment is really straightforward. Deploy automations, which are specific to what the company wants. Usually the way I lead with this is I say, tell me the top five things that you could automate in your business to make it better. And usually it's like new user creation, app deployment, you know, site creation, stuff like that, right? Also, check out the System Center Service Manager Survival Guide. That is, I got a lot of MVP blogs on it. It's got a lot of great information, and it's a great way to get kickstarted in a service manager. Also, the System Center Engineering blog is one of the most frequently updated blogs in the whole Microsoft realm. And they've got some really great guys, especially Travis Wright, just does an awesome job of updating information and giving links to people who are doing interesting things with Service Manager. You'll find that Service Manager is one of the hottest community-supported products, because everybody's building automations, so you'll see that everybody's doing all these little different things. So anytime you want to do something, there's great people who are already researching these things. On my blog, I have some of the leave-behinds. I'll give you a couple examples. I've oriented this up here. So we have our the service planning worksheets. the unsealed management pack extensions for software extensions, the AD run book. Go and get the Twitter integration pack that I figured I had didn't have to build after I built it. And then these two guides walk through the different performance and service dashboards. So I would say that those will save you a lot of time. I think they'll be really useful for you. Let's see if my blog got up there. There it is. Great. Cool. All right. So let's jump into some questions. Who has some questions that they'd like to answer? Yeah. Oh, great question. So the first thing I'd use when I'm talking about sizing is I'd go out to the, there's a SM Sizer tool, and that allows you to differentiate between different big block sizes of Service Manager deployments, and that's very helpful because it gives you good implementation groupings. Now, the one that I have up there with the four servers, that'll serve about a 5,000 user deployment, but if you want it redundant, then you start to break out those access servers. The access servers are grouped in quantities of 30 to 60 consoles. So it's very useful in terms of organizing those additional access servers. Now, the greater size deployment that I walk through, that's for a much larger set. Think like 20,000 plus type of implementations are going to have the split SQL servers, the split data warehouse and split service manager management servers, the orchestrator server, and then the runbook servers. You're going to break those out for performance reasons, right? And that allows you to have a great scalability of your environment. Does that answer your question? Awesome. What other questions do we have out there? Yep. That's a great question because you can't install the agent, right? I had to do agentless is the only option. Correct. Yep. Yep. At this point, that's the only option. I believe they're going to resolve that, but it's not going to be by installing the agent simply because they share the same agent. Yep. What other questions? Yep. Ah, good question. All right. So let's jump into that. Oh, sure thing. So he asked, how do you maintain the service accounts that are tied to each of the individual services that you're managing? So if you're connecting to Active Directory or Exchange or somewhere else through Orchestrator, how do you manage those? Where do they go? So there's three places they could go. One is in a text file that then is you grab a secure user from, and I use that in that PowerShell script. Another is in the individual connection. So in my connections, if I go to options here and I say Active Directory, you'll see that I have a concurrency AD connector. In here is the account that I use to connect to Active Directory. Same thing with Service Manager or with Operations Manager. So if I look at Service Manager, for example, there's my two Service Manager connections. Both are using my account SCSM admin, right? A last app option that we've used quite frequently is we build a variable. So underneath Service Manager, Orchestrator in here, underneath global settings, are these variables. And these variables can include different accounts that I'm using to be able to maintain different information. And then also something else you should know about is counters. So like, for example, when I'm doing new workstation deployments, I've got an incrementing counter variable that I use to automatically name these workstations. Some people like to do it on the serial number and stuff. I like to just kind of do an incrementing counter. You can also maintain those information in there over time to be able to do new deployments. Go ahead. Will it work with managed service accounts? It will. I haven't personally used them, but I know it does because I'm heard of other people who've used it with SharePoint. What other questions do you have? Yep. Oh, so the question is, if it goes through there, can you have it come back to the UI to either give a status or ask more questions? Okay. So you absolutely can give status. So status is done in every single request. Something you guys should know is that if you have a request which is which is treed. So see in my OS deployment process, I have these secondary steps. The status of a secondary step doesn't make it back to the parent step unless you have a specific component in there to do it. So you have to bubble back that status so you have a failed or successful, but it will make it back to the request. So if I look at my requests in the Service Manager UI in the console here, I'm going to see which ones are completed. So here's the three that we had just done. These have a step of completed. Now, if you wanted to have a process where it needed an approval, let's say I needed an approval before I could send a tweet, right? What will happen is it will actually insert a review activity before the actual action occurs. So I'd, by default, have a two-step process, and then I'd insert those approvals as a second step. And that allows for me to be able to manage that over time. What I find is that here I'm typically bubbling up status so the users know about it, but I'm not bubbling up like every individual orchestration process that's running behind the scenes. All right. What other questions do you have? Yeah. Oh, great question. So the question is, if you already have a portal, can you do a phased approach where you use Orchestrator? Sure, you can. Absolutely. So there's two reasons why you would do that. One would be, like, let's say that you already have a SharePoint portal. Maybe you don't use SharePoint, but let's say you already have a SharePoint portal. Well, this is a web part for SharePoint, right? So I can put this in existing SharePoint environments, and they can leverage it. However, let's say I just want to use Orchestrator, and before I use Service Manager, I just want to leverage Orchestrator. What you can do is Orchestrator can actually look at an existing SharePoint list. So you can say, okay, my request is going to gather information from a SharePoint list, and then Orchestrator is going to look at that list and pull information from it to be able to do the automation. That's really useful for unauthenticated requests. So let's say you've got a portal end user website out on the internet, and you want people to be able to go there and put information into the request and then submit. And then Orchestrator goes and pulls in information, opens up a service request, or does some sort of automation. That would allow you to be able to do that without having Service Manager be the place that the request is coming from. If it's not like a Microsoft SharePoint site, if it's some other kind of portal, you'd have to have a mechanism for Orchestrator to go and get it. And that could either by having it look at a directory or look at if you have an API it can access through or PowerShell it can access through. So Orchestrator has a lot of ways to go out and get information and then run on a timed process its automation. So absolutely, you can run Orchestrator sort of in an initial environment and then add Service Manager later. To TFS. So the question is, does Orchestrator already have runbooks built to connect to TFS? There are already connectors out there for TFS on the gallery. So you can leverage those. Yep. What other questions? Yep. Yep, great question. I have used the Cloud Process Pack, and I've used it quite extensively. And I've also combined it with sort of additions to the Cloud Process Pack to be able to manage some of the Azure things before Service Pack 1's out. I don't believe that upgrading in place RC to RTM is supported. Now, we were in the TAP, so we had a couple additional things that we were able to do. So you can kind of use your own guesswork on that. But I think your best approach is probably to remove and install. But you can certainly try. It just won't be supported. You're not going to be able to call up Microsoft and say, I'm upgrading from RC to RTM, and I want you to give me support on that upgrade process. But you're certainly welcome to give it a shot. Any other questions? Awesome, great. Well, it was a real blessing to talk to you guys today. Thank you for taking time to come to the session. Go ahead and fill out your evals. Go get the leave-behinds that we have out there. And if you have some questions offline afterward, come on up and we'll chat through it or demo it if you want to see it. Thanks a lot.